Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and I am sharing part five today of an in-depth, original investigative reporting white paper, Saving the Planet, Saving Our Lives. Today we're going to talk about soil and soil erosion. If you want to see how bad it can be, take a look at Africa. Look at the Middle East. Look at Syria and Lebanon. And look at Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Yes, these places are suffering from severe drought. Now, they are very rich countries, and they've been able to, in effect, create a beautiful oasis of green where they can plant wheat and vegetables. But now that's not possible because the water that they were using has been depleted. It's gone. So they're going into other countries, countries that have good soil and nice weather and just the right amount of rain, and they're leasing or buying huge acreage, including in the United States. And there they're having specialists grow for them and then transport it over to Saudi Arabia or Kuwait so that they can have food. In the 1930s, we suffered from what was known as the Great Dust Bowl. It was man-made. For dozens of years, we would grow whatever we wanted because the soil and the great breadbaskets of Kansas and Indiana and Oklahoma were plentiful. The soil contained the nutrients, the organic materials, to sustain crops. But then along came a major shift. From being able to grow multiple items at the same time, have fruit trees and nut trees, have grains and legumes and beans and seeds, growing sunflower seeds or pumpkin seeds or sesame seeds. Instead, farmers were given a deal. Grow one crop, let's say wheat or corn, and we will guarantee you a price per bushel. And for a period of time, it went very well for the farmers. Now, the farmer could only grow once a year, didn't have to worry about drying or canning, didn't have to worry about tending to the soil all year and resting part of the fields for one or two years so that they can recolonize good bacteria. No, didn't have to do any of that. And as a result, now the farmer had to go to the store to buy a loaf of bread before they would make their own bread. They would go to buy their meats and fruits, things that used to be completely self-sustained. Now they didn't. But they did get their money, and it only took part of the year. The rest of the year, they could do other things. They didn't have to tend to the ground. Now, I had a great aunt who had one of the most biodynamic farms you could imagine. In fact, my mother and her sisters and brothers lived there during the Great Depression. There was a barn that had a root cellar in it, and in that root cellar, which was about 8 feet below ground, so it stayed around 55 degrees 12 months a year, it was all lined with bricks, and then in between the bricks she put bee propolis, which is a natural antibiotic. That's what bees put in their own hives to prevent infections. Well, in any case, she had over 100 barrels, and these were giant 55-gallon barrels, wooden barrels, that she would dry everything that she had grown that wasn't going to be used fresh, like apples and peaches and pears and grapes. She must have had 30 different types of fruit that she was growing, and then they would dry them on screens with a muslin cloth over them, some kind of cloth to keep the insects off. It took about 4 or 5 days, and then they would be sealed in there, and she would date it and label it. And then she also did the same thing for vegetables. She would dry string beans and dry tomatoes and dry peppers, as they have historically done throughout the world and other cultures for a long time. And then she had a smokehouse where if she had fish from the Ohio River, which is nearby, or if she might have had some other thing like a rabbit or venison, they would be dehydrated with a basting brush of salt water. You take this salt water brush and wipe down the carcass, and it would dry from the heat underneath. And depending upon which wood they would use, then that would be the flavor of the what would end up being a jerky. Though there was so much dehydration that the animal, in effect, was looking like a mummy. But then they would baste that in a mixture of raw honey and bee propolis, and then wrap it and salt it, and that would keep it preserved for long periods of time. And therefore, in the middle of the winter, when they wanted a stew, if they chose, they could rip off a piece or tear it, or hence jerk it off, and put it in the pot, and then with some vegetables and water, and now it would rehydrate. The vegetables rehydrate, and then you had a full stew. That's how a lot of Americans and the pioneers were able to exist. And it was about, around 130-acre farm. But she had her own bakery. She baked everything herself, from pies to breads, whole grain. She had a stone grinding mill where she ground the grain so everything was whole. Nothing was wasted. Nothing was lost. And she was completely self-sufficient. But the other farmers around her, who were also equally self-sufficient, who also had all kinds of nut trees and fruit trees and grains, they took the bait when the people came around and says, we'll pay you this amount for a bushel of wheat. So now they no longer tended the soil. They simply exploited it. And for 10, even 20 years, it worked. And then it didn't. And then the soil became drier. The essential nutrients were diminished. In the wintertime, where my aunt would plant a green crop and then bury it in the spring, that was renourishing, in effect, rejuvenating the soil, and it prevented soil erosion. All that was gone now, so the soil had nothing on it in the wintertime. After they harvested their wheat or corn, it was just barren soil. So when winter came and the snows froze the ground, and then in the spring when it thawed and it was all washed off, that soil was washed with it. So in time, a great, beautiful piece of land became barren. And then the winds came and took that dirt and created dust storms. And that is a major catastrophe in American history. Now we have the same kind of dust storms, but we also have sandstorms. A heavy sandstorm was reported this year in Phoenix that covered the entire city, the entire length of the city. It was huge, and they had never experienced anything like that before. Well, you get a 20-mile sandstorm coming, and it hits your car, it hits a tree, hits your house, it's going to leave some damage. Now, they're used to that in the deserts of the Middle East. We're not used to that in mid-America. So it was kind of a wake-up call. Pay attention, nature was saying. You have not been tending to your stewardship. You have not cared about what nature needs in order to help you sustain life. In 2016, biologists at Kansas State University identified a new positive feedback loop that will only increase future warming. The planet's soil is one of the Earth's most important carbon sinks. And globally, the study's lead researcher, John Blair, wrote, soils hold more than twice as much carbon as the atmosphere. Well, consequently, even a small rise in carbon release from soil can have a large impact on atmospheric greenhouse gases and future warming. In fact, in the near future, the release of soil carbon will be equivalent to 17% of human greenhouse gases. And that is really, really dangerous. See, warming weather advances soil CO2 release, thereby contributing to further warming and in turn accelerates future and further soil carbon release. It's a cycle. It's a feedback loop. In fact, Kansas State's study was confirmed by further expanded on upon the following year by scientists at Wood Hole's Marine Biology Laboratory. They had a long 26-year study and concluded that a self-reinforcing and perhaps uncontrollable, that's their words, not mine, perhaps uncontrollable positive feedback loop is occurring between forest soil and global warming as the microbial activity accelerates in warmer soils. The study discovered that the soil's microbiome undergoes a cycle of stages in its activity, and currently the planet's soil is in a dormant phase, but in several more years, it's predicted to arouse again with a higher degree of severity. And there's no way to turn the Earth's soil microbacterial activity off. We've had flooding and extreme storms. In addition to modern industrial agricultural practices, erode soil, thereby removing the organic medium necessary for plants and crops to absorb CO2. So as soil dries up, it releases CO2 and methane. Now we can think of organic soil as an enormous bank vault for carbon. However, when soil loses its organic ingredients, becoming dry and lifeless, rather than containing carbon, it releases it. It is estimated that if all the world's soil were too dry by just 0.3%, that's one-third of 1%, it would release an entire year's worth of fossil fuel emissions. Loss of soil means lower crop yields at a time when the world's population continues to grow. Food insecurity will become a global problem with immense ramifications for social and political stability. The U.S. is particularly subject to agricultural collapse due to the over-reliance upon large-scale industrial agriculture, immersed with pesticides and fertilizers, which further erode topsoil. Climate change, as well as rising competition, have already adversely affected America's wheat yields. For decades, the U.S. was the leading wheat producer and exporter. Yields are now decreasing. And in 2016, Russia topped the United States as the leading producer of wheat in the world. In addition, lower crop yields will result in a greater divide between supply and demand. Well, you know what that means. Food prices are going to skyrocket. California is America's breadbasket. It grows and exports over 400 types of agricultural products. Well, the 6 to 7 year drought, meaning less rainfall, higher temperatures, and radiating sun, meant lower yields in corn, wheat, alfalfa, all of the tree nuts, and fruits and citrus and vine-growing foods and other crops, costing farmers billions of dollars in lost revenues. Moreover, longer drought episodes require more water. Already, climate change is affecting California's winter snowpack, which is recording all-time lows. Water levels in reservoirs and aquifers are declining, giving the current agricultural method employed on most California farms, meaning monoculture, one crop, the situation is unsustainable if temperatures continue to rise and for longer stretches of time, and that's exactly what's been predicted. Here's the irony. It was only a little over a year ago that they had torrential rain. So everyone said, this is good. Now we have all the rain to fill our aquifers. And indeed, aquifers were refilled, and many of the deeper aquifers were recharged. However, I said at the time on my daily radio program, this is a double-edged sword. To have torrential rain for weeks will cause a lot of new seedlings to begin to sprout. Now, once those seedlings sprout and become weeds or grasses, then you're going to go into a drought. And when the drought cycle comes, that's going to dry all that grass up, and then that's going to be tinder for fire. Well, that's exactly what's happened. If you were to have driven through Napa Valley up in the wine country in Northern California, you would have seen no green but dry and dry and drier. Did the state move ahead of this to implement a major campaign to try to protect the homes? No. Did the developers? No. Did the individuals owning homes? No, because no one figured that a fire would be so bad, come so fast, and be so unexpected, with no warnings. Some people only had 5 minutes to get out of their house and take whatever belongings they had, that it caught them by surprise. It should not, but that's what happens when you live in denial of your relationship to your environment. There are certain places in the United States that are no longer sustainable, and yet we continue to move by the oceans down in Miami and down by Homestead, going clear into Key West, Key Largo. And yet when a fire comes and when a home is destroyed, or when a tide comes up at night and suddenly you've got 18 inches of water in the streets and mosquitoes behind that nesting in that water and a terrible fishy smell. And then when the storms do come and wash out massive amounts of sand, and then it destabilizes the very foundations of a people's homes or giant buildings. What do you think all those buildings are resting upon? They're not resting upon hard rock or concrete. No, they're resting upon sand. And in time, as every tide comes out in the morning after being high at night, it's taking sand with it and destabilizing. So I predict that within the next 10 years, hundreds of buildings, thousands of homes will be simply inundated by tidal water at night, making the structures incompatible with a sustainable life. Now, so we're not paying attention to the basics. We're not paying attention to agricultural methods. We're not paying attention to what's going on in California with the farms, let alone the only attention we are drawing, and that's just for a short news cycle, is the houses are on fire. As a result, we will end up with hunger, more hunger. Already, according to the Global Health Institute, they published this in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the rise in plant diseases has caused a 16% decrease in crop yields. Fields with poor soil and heat scorch produce weaker plants that are more susceptible to illness. It's no different than if you're under chronic stress and if you're malnourished, you're far more likely to have an infection or something that comes from a depleted immune system. Well, the plants have immune systems also, and the soil has an immune system, and we haven't paid attention to either. We have been so negligent on this. I often encourage my radio program audience to learn something about farming and start to grow their own food, because there'll come a time when we can no longer assume that all the foods we are accustomed to on grocery shelves will be readily available or even affordable if they are available. Today, there are numerous methods and a large array of innovative resources and information to learn to grow a large variety of foods in our own homes and yards and roofs and neighborhoods. This is a time when all we need to learn to become farmers is available. Because if we don't pay attention, then one day we're going to wake up and we're going to see desertification. An extensive review of the scientific literature regarding the status of the planet's major deserts unanimously confirms climate change's impact upon these very sensitive ecosystems. The world's deserts, which make up approximately a quarter of the Earth's landmass, are growing instead of retreating. Rising temperatures and higher concentrations of greenhouse gases are only one of the problems. In the semi-arid regions, often bordering larger deserts, direct human activity is largely to blame, meaning overgrazing of cattle and over-irrigation that raises the soil salt levels and mining activities and the extraction of fossil fuels. All of these factors combined are turning semi-arid areas into deserts. The major deserts of the world, the Sahara Desert, the Arabian Desert, the Gobi Desert, the Kalahari Desert, Australia's Great Victorian Desert, the Syrian Desert, the Great Basin Desert in the United States. In fact, the Earth's two largest deserts are the Antarctic and the Arctic deserts, which comprise 14 million and 13.7 million square miles, respectively, are not the only areas where desertification is occurring. Just last year, the European Center for Geoscience Research in France published a paper warning that much of southern Europe's land along the Mediterranean will shift into desert conditions if the planet's temperature reaches 2 degrees Celsius. And it's going to. The study compared parts of France, Portugal, and Spain with current conditions facing the American Southwest, where semi-arid lands are undergoing rapid desertification. And by the way, I've been to Italy and Spain and all these countries, and 25 to 30 years ago, you could go through thousands of acres of olive gardens, orchards, with lush soil. Some of those orchards were 500 to 1,000 years old, the trees. Now, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, massive desertification. And that's unfortunate. So you may think that the warming of remote deserts will have little, if any, impact upon our own lives. However, the new climate world we now live in is also altering global wind patterns and their intensity. If it is late spring or early summer, and you're reading a report about the environment and happen to be on the Atlantic coast and sneezing, it could be that the river of dust has reached your home from the Sahara Desert. Tons of sand rise in the North African deserts annually and find its easy way across the ocean and settles across the Americas. This means that sands and dust from desert wind storms, besides affecting populations in cities and towns on the outskirts of the deserts, can reach across many thousands of miles. One study out of the universities of Houston and Miami measured Saharan dust doubling the atmospheric dust over Houston. The drying of the American Southwest states now contributing to enormous dust storms enveloping Phoenix will carry particles from low-lying regions to higher altitudes where snowpack is an invaluable water source. And through the American West, mountain snowpack is declining and melting faster. The role desert deposits play in the dramatic changes occurring in high-altitude snow dynamics was confirmed by a joint study conducted by NASA and the University of Colorado just in 2013. Now, there's an upside, nevertheless, to dust storms. Aside from the serious risks that excessive atmospheric sand and dust poses to animals and human health, an increase in atmospheric particles from the desert has a dimming effect. What do I mean? After especially large wind storms in deserts, the sands cool. Sandstorms are extremely important events for sustaining deserts' fragile ecologies. And unlike greenhouse gases, which remain in the troposphere for many years, desert particles settle relatively rapidly. They serve as a thermostat for temperature swings necessary for desert life. However, when combined with many other climate change feedback loops, dust and sandstorms also exacerbate and accelerate the problems of a warming Earth. Now, other positive feedback loops that will further contribute to the release of greenhouse gases, and by the way, some were presented and discussed in detail earlier in our discussions, but the weakening of the ecosystem's resilience will increase pests, meaning when it gets hot, let's say in Florida and Louisiana and Alabama and Texas, hotter than normal, that heat doesn't just stay in those areas. It migrates up into Georgia and South Carolina, North Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and northern areas of Mississippi and Louisiana. When it does this, trees that historically have not had a problem with the temperature and insects suddenly are getting too dry. The soil's too hot. Well, guess what comes with all that heat? Beetles. Billions of them. They get into the trees. The tree is weak. It has a weakened immune system. And they nest in the trees, lay eggs in the trees, and they consume the essential nutrients of the trees. As a result, as the pests increase, the trees die. Then the beetles continue to go north, and because it's getting warmer and warmer and warmer in season, the beetles are right behind them. In the last 12 months, California alone has lost over 150 million trees. So this is one of the offshoots of this. And also disruption of the thermohaline conveyor belt due to melting ice in the ocean off the coast of Antarctica and also in the Arctic and also the coast of Greenland. And the result has been an added force contributing to the melting of polar permafrost and less salty offshore ocean surfaces. There may come a day when the conveyor belt slows down to a point where it no longer functions or stops. If that happens, you're going to have a radical change in temperature from the entire Mediterranean area right up through Ireland and Scotland and Great Britain. You also have, as beetles and other disease-causing pests migrate further north, trees and plants will die off more rapidly. When they die, those places are now susceptible to fires. Dead forests will further release methane, which had been trapped, and that will in turn ignite really bad wildfires, which in turn emit massive amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And soil erosion due to extreme storms and floods remove the organic medium that enables plants to grow and absorb CO2. And the increase in severity of extreme weather events creates conditions whereby less CO2 is absorbed, which then accelerates warming and in turn aggravates conditions responsible for more extreme weather events. And sea level rise combined with floods creates new swamps that over time will release more methane. And most people are not aware that when the tide comes in at night, it frequently is coming in so far that the water then goes into the ground, especially if it's very loamy and sandy, and can go into the local shallow aquifers. Many aquifers in Florida are 30 feet deep, 20 feet deep. Why do you think there are no building codes that allow basements in Florida? Because the water table is so high. All right, so let's say that you have salt water coming in. That means your aquifer, your well, becomes salty. That is a big problem. Now, that also means that many of the plants that are growing from natural grasses and trees are going to be, every 24 hours, they're going to go through a cycle of very salty water getting into the root systems. That'll kill and rot many of these plants. We also have the earth being in a rising temperature, which leads to higher water vapor humidity entering the stratosphere, which resides above the troposphere, and this activity is already responsible for 5 to 10% of total global warming. And rising atmosphere and CO2 accelerates the loss of carbon sequestered in forest soil. Warmer ocean waters kill off phytoplankton, which are crucial for sequestering CO2. And as ice in the higher altitudes get thinner, such as in Antarctica, parts of Greenland and mountain glaciers around the world, like the Himalayas, not only will sea levels rise, but it hastens the pace for when there will be no more ice caps, no more sheets of ice to absorb hundreds of quintillions of energy as they melt. Extreme storms and hurricanes and typhoons create updrafts that carry moisture into the stratosphere. This will reduce atmospheric ozone and allow storage of more water vapor greenhouse gas. And the Northern Hemisphere climate zones consist of three separate cells, or climate bands, acting individually and together with each other. And besides the tropical equator and the North Pole is a middle cell where the majority of the forests and the major food crops thrive. This zone includes the major portion of the United States, that's our big eight-state breadbasket, plus California and Florida and Texas, in Europe, in Russia, and in China. So the loss of this middle cell due to overheating will force the heat from the equator to reach the poles more efficiently. You don't want that. You don't want the melting of the poles. And finally, although it is very convenient to toss all the blame for climate change upon the backs of runaway neoliberal capitalism, the fossil fuel and agrochemical corporations and mega building construction and development in other industries, we must also look at our own individual carbon footprint. A decade ago, China surpassed the United States for the number one position in greenhouse gas emissions. However, American families still hold the top position in the average carbon footprint per person. Astronomically so. For one recent year, every American was associated with a 16 metric tons of CO2 emissions. In China, with over 1.3 billion citizens, four times larger than the United States, had an average footprint of 7.2. So 16.2 metric tons released in a year versus for every citizen versus 7.2 metric tons. So it shows you we are the world's most intense polluter, even if China has the most pollution. So most of what we own and eat and do leaves a carbon residue behind. The energy used to heat and cool our homes and automobiles, our air flights, our daily diet, our clothes, textiles, computers, electronic equipment, and other manufactured goods, our reliance upon telephones and mobiles and the internet and pharmaceutical drugs and much more. The Center for Sustainable Systems at the University of Michigan annually generates a carbon footprint fact sheet. And if we look at our household food consumption alone, we can get a deeper appreciation of our individual contribution to climate change. Although agriculture constitutes only 5.8% of total human-generated CO2 emissions, this is according to the EPA, international estimates from the World Resources Institute and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization places the figure as high as 18%. The average American household food consumption is responsible for emitting 8.1 metric tons of CO2e every year. The livestock industry, there's your meat and your chickens and your pork, which provides meat and dairy products, emits far more greenhouse gases and methane and nitrous oxide in particular than fruit and grain and vegetable agriculture. So raising animals for food is a far less efficient use of energy because of the lengthier transfer of energy from soil to plant to animal and eventually to our dining table. Meat and dairy adds 47% and 19% respectively to the total greenhouse gases in the food sector, including transportation. Now compare this with the 3.6% for fruits and 3% for grains and 4.9% for vegetables. Huge, huge difference in helping the environment lower carbon footprint when you go to a plant-based diet. If a person were to eat only locally grown food for a single year, it would be the equivalent of not driving 1,000 miles in your vehicle. So going vegetarian for only one day a week would save the equivalent of driving 1,160 miles a year. So adopting the habit of purchasing only organically grown food instead of conventional produce saves between 30 to 50% of our energy usage. So the question then becomes, what will the climate mean to us in the future? There are many illnesses challenging humanity and the global environment that are increasingly consuming the present and will continue to do so in the future. There is social and economic inequality and a growing disparity between the haves and have-nots. There is serious crisis in sustainable human development, with poverty growing in many parts of the world. Women and children and the youth continue to be victims of imbalanced power forces at many social levels and across cultures. For example, among all developed nations, the United States remains second only to Japan with the smallest percentage of elected women leaders in public office. So wars and conflicts continue, all inevitably associated with land possession and competition for natural resources, such as water rights, as in some of the African tribal conflicts, and possession of physical places considered holy by warring constituencies. There are many other imbalances between the various organs of humanity's body that are reacting in a critical way, and this is not being discussed in any open way. In effect, we are being brought to a place of humanity's unconscious shadow self. And as this discussion has intended to convey, there is the overwhelming specter of climate change and global warming hovering over our way of life, our environment, for the future. In large measure, the engine driving our planet towards a 4-degree Celsius increase higher has been the exploitation of the Earth's natural resources. We're not going to make it if we continue this way. We're just not. People worry about their future in more or less smaller degrees. We also tend to find different worrisome developments in our world that bother some people more than others. In my estimation, there are three principal categories that are today leading our world towards an apocalyptic conclusion in our lifetimes. In fact, nearer in our lifetimes than further. And disruption of the planet's biodiversity and ecological balance, and the acceleration of conflict and war and hatred, and finally, growing inequality and poverty. Now, although each refers to various sets of critical issues and crises, all are intermeshed, since climate change is probably the most concrete example of a holistic system theory operating throughout our daily lives. At the same time, all of these refer back ultimately to the more essential spiritual crisis confronting humanity and the degradation of this and the descent of ethical values. And I'm very concerned because no single person or institution can accurately surmise what the future holds as the Earth continues to warm. Numerous scenarios can be imagined, each mixed with some truths and some falsehoods. How populations and governments and corporations and international institutions respond when the kettle starts boiling are also unpredictable. They may turn more progressive to solutions and work in communal harmony together to address the global issues, or conceivably they may descend into authoritarian and fascist tribalism. Let's just put it this way. What do you think the likely outcome is if you have 10 million millionaires and their family? That means you get about 40 million people who are very wealthy, and you have a professional class of 17 million with their family. So between the two, you're dealing with nearly 100 million people, more or less. And these people have the means to purchase whatever food is available and have the highest quality of food. How long do you think it's going to take before we have no more food to ship overseas to nations that have relied upon us for wheat or corn or other products because they were not able to grow it in their own communities? Already in the last 2 years, there's been over 30 major food riot crises where people simply were going hungry and they rampaged. Right now, as I speak, and probably for the next several years, there is a major food crisis in one of the most, let's say, densely populated and poor nations in the Middle East, in Yemen. It's estimated that 90% of the population are nutritionally deficient. Many are starving to death, and children in particular are dying by the thousands. On top of that, 500,000 to a million are now affected with cholera, and there is a typhoid plague going around as well, all because of the war that is occurring between the United States and Great Britain and France, supporting Saudi Arabia, along with the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Bahrain, all against this tiny little country, poor as can be, and they're starving. You don't hear a word about it in the United States media, and that's unfortunate. So what happens now when we have 16 million hungry children each day who are food insecure? They're not starving to death, but they're not getting the nutrients they need. They're hungry. They go to bed hungry. So now we're facing situations similar to, actually greater than, the Great Depression. We have 50 million Americans on food stamps. We have 2.5 million children who go to school each day who are homeless. They have no home to go to when they leave school. Might be a RV, might be a car or a van. And on top of all this inequality, we then have people who have all the money and politicians who do their bidding, but not ours, at the state level and the federal level. And it's only a matter of time before we begin to restrict the movement of those who the greater society of wealth considers may be a threat. So you may have green zones throughout the United States, 1,000 or 2,000 of them, where you have very affluent neighborhoods or gated communities or parts of cities where you can only get in there to work if you have an ID and you have a pass that allows you to go in and out. What's that mean for the rest of people? What's that mean for where they're supposed to get their food? How are they supposed to survive? At that point, if that should happen, I hope it does not, but I've been speaking with many people who are trends professionals. They see trends, they look at trends, and they believe that we are about 5 years from that happening. They believe that when the dollar is no longer the exclusive reserve currency with the greatest value, but is one of the weakest because there's nothing backing it up. It's just a fiat currency. And the ruble backed by gold and the yuan backed by gold and other currencies that are more stable, when the dollar no longer is supreme, imagine all the businesses that will fail. Imagine the people that go broke because the dollar will start to lose its value. We don't talk about this, but we should. We don't talk about inequality. We rarely show its presence. Instead, we divert ourselves more often than not away from the major problems, including environmental problems, to that which allows us the bread and circuses, the reality shows. And that we do at our own risk. We do not have to look any further than the U.S. Pentagon's own assessment to become critically warned about what climate change portends for the future. The Pentagon report, entitled "An Abrupt Climate Change Scenario and Its Implications for United States National Security," states, I'm going to quote this, "An abrupt climate change scenario could potentially destabilize the geopolitical environment, leading to skirmishes, battles, and even wars due to resource constraints," end quote. Again, in 2015, another Pentagon study commissioned by Congress as a follow-up to its climate change adaption roadmap reported in no uncertain terms that climate change is the number one national security threat facing the nation. All of the adverse environmental effects scientists have been warning about for years were restated, including the dangers of melting polar ice and sea levels rise and more frequent extreme weather events and more devastating floods and wildfires and droughts. Depending upon where you live, the harsh reality of climate change will be felt differently. As I explained earlier, American coastlines, especially along the Atlantic seaboard, from the Florida Keys to Boston will experience the brunt of sea level rises. All the major cities dotted along the Arctic are sitting ducks for extreme storms and ocean surges and increased flooding. And no major concerted effort is being made to prevent or lessen any of the impacts of higher category storms and rising tides. On the other hand, inland, New England to eastern New York, along with the northern Midwest regions near the Great Lakes, are the best positioned for the decades ahead. Vermont, for example, is the most politically progressive and environmentally friendly state in the nation. A joint collaboration between the state government and Vermont's universities and local farming and renewable energy organizations has brought the state to 90% self-reliance for its energy, food, and housing needs, compared to the dismal sustainability statistics throughout most of the remaining 49 states. This is a remarkable proactive achievement. But climate change gives no consideration for borders and boundaries, nor states' legislatures. Excessive rains, which will contribute to floods, will likely plague even the best and healthiest of regions. During extreme flooding events, crops will be destroyed and orchards damaged across the inland, northeastern states as well. And for much of the remainder of the United States, aside from local regions commonly referred to as lifeboat zones, conditions will worsen from longer periods of drought and extreme storms and tornadoes and water shortages. Again, it is the agricultural industrial paradigm, along with the oil and natural gas companies, deteriorating the landscape, which will make future warming even more devastating. Although several decades away, the Ogallala Fossil Water Aquifer, which provides 8 states from South Dakota to Texas with the water necessary for extensive irrigation, is gradually being depleted. Now, this is the breadbasket of America, supplying at least 20% of the nation's crop harvest. And this 10-million-year-old deep aquifer reservoir was created during the Pliocene Age and would require over 6,000 years to replenish itself naturally. In some regions, such as western Kansas, the water level is going to be substantially lower than what it's been now, which means that it's going to decline to where some states won't have it to use. And industrial agriculture is water intensive. U.S. farms use approximately 57 million gallons of water every 24 hours for irrigation. And this is almost 300% more than water consumed daily through our public water supply systems that feed into our homes and businesses. And chemical-based agriculture, because it contributes to rapid soil degradation and erosion, requires far more water than organic farming to produce a similar yield. Now, organic living soil retains moisture and also uses nitrogen more efficiently. And finally, since organic agriculture has no need for chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides, it produces only a small carbon footprint. A study conducted by the Rodale Institute measured the amount of energy required to grow a hectare of organic corn versus a hectare of corn using conventional chemical methods. On average, the conventional crop required 71% more energy than the organic, and 41% of this energy excess was due to the use of nitrogen-based fertilizers. However, aside from conventional agriculture's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, it also threatens our nation's food security. First, it is a monocrop-based system. A single virulent pesticide-resistant organism could destroy millions of acres of crops. And second, the entire model destroys the immunity of the land and the crops and the plants themselves. Keep in mind that plants are living beings too. Imagine if you were sprayed down several times a year with toxic poisons. Surely your immune system would weaken and leave you vulnerable to a wide variety of illnesses and diseases and infections. Plant foods are no different. That's correct. In brief, chemical agriculture is completely antithetical to the art and science of farming. It is nothing more than a profit-driven enterprise, impoverished of any scientific or moral ground given to human health. Future crop and food security and ecological sustainability are not even in its consciousness. And globally, agriculture contributes to approximately 5% of all anthropogenic CO2 emissions, between 10 to 12% of all methane, particularly from livestock, and between 33 to 60% of nitrous oxide. Well, big agricultural firms are largely the responsible culprit. This industry is every bit on par with the worst exploiters and peddlers of fossil fuels. And this should be an additional incentive for people to avoid eating foods grown with GMOs or conventional means. The moral imperative to boycott and refuse to purchase chemically grown produce and genetically altered foods engineered by corporations such as Monsanto and DuPont is, in my personal opinion, critical. On the other hand, organic agricultural methods depend upon the health and sustainability of soils, the biosystems surrounding farms and the farmers themselves. In a paper comparing the pros and cons of organic and conventional agricultural methods published in Critical Reviews in Plant Sciences, beautifully surmises the means and ethic behind organic farming. The authors state that organic methods, quote, rely on ecological process and biodiversity and cycles adopted to local conditions rather than the use of inputs with adverse effects. Well, these foreign inputs include toxic chemicals, synthetic fertilizers, extensive chemical tilling, and inordinate amounts of irrigation. The scientists conclude, quote, organic agriculture combines tradition, innovation, and science to benefit the shared environment and promote fair relationships and a good quality of life for all involved. I think that's terrific, and that's important. The collapse of the nation's food security, either through drought associated with global warming, extreme flooding, or the over-reliance of industrial agriculture technology, has other adverse effects besides higher food prices. It will also trigger border conflicts between various factions and nations, and even wars. For many millions of people around the world, climate change is going to make day-to-day life increasingly unbearable. A 2015 Pentagon report cited the whole idea that what you're going to have is severe conditions and will represent a major national security threat. Remember, we're having prolonged droughts now. Syria was tormented by its worst recorded drought between 2006 and 2010 and likely contributed by man-induced climate change. And this prolonged drought destroyed the country's breadbasket, which happened to include the city of Aleppo that had become a stronghold for ISIS. Now, already water stressed, the drought reduced precipitation during the wet season dramatically, and over 200,000 Syrian farmers lost their lands because of water shortages. And this played a significant role in the massive migration of people out of Syria into Europe. And although other factors played a significant role in the eruption of an Arab Spring and civil war and the rise of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the U.S. intervention in Syria to foment regime change and a growing body of research indicates that environmental conditions were a huge contributing factor to the instability of Syria that has led to the conflict. We have to understand that. In recent years, several important publications, including Harold Welzler's Climate Wars, Why People Will Kill Each Other in the 21st Century, and Christian Parenti's Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, and Gwen Dyer's Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, each predicts the growing conflicts, struggles, and violence that will increase as we march towards a 2 to 3 degrees Celsius increase. And then eventually it's going to hit 4 degrees. And this dire future is compounded by a population boom that has nearly doubled since 1960. And the future will surely face insufficient resources, lower agricultural crop yields, growing inequality, and corporate and government corruption. It is therefore imperative for people to begin to wake up to this new environmental reality. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
So, bring what time do you want me to set everything up for the 7 o'clock? Like 6:40, 6:30?
Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. See, war is not
let me try.
Answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see what's going on.